Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. This is your host, Sher Ali Tareen. For each new episode, we choose an important new book in the broader field of Islamic studies and we chat with its author. In their landmark new translation of the Quran, titled The Quran, A Verse Translation, Rafi Habib and Bruce Lawrence translate the entirety of the Quran in a fashion that beautifully and majestically captures the poetic sensibility of the Quran for contemporary English speakers and readers. The distinctive feature of this Quran translation is its close attentiveness to the literary possibilities opened by the versification of the text, and to the oral and aural capacities of the Quran, punctuated by its rhythmic qualities. This book also includes a very helpful glossary and appendix, as well as a deeply erudite account of the translation theory and thought process that went into the composition of this Quran translation. This powerful, mellifluous, and often dazzling translation is sure to alternatively jolt and energize the reader. It would also work as a great Quran translation in courses on various topics concerning Islam and Muslim societies. Here now is my conversation with Dr. Rafi Habib and Bruce Lawrence. Thank you, Dr. Lawrence and Dr. Habib, for your time and for this really splendid and really landmark translation of the Quran that I'm really excited to talk about, which I think will be a tremendous resource in the classroom in terms of discussions in the Quran, and I think for Muslims as well. It's a really fantastic opportunity and resource. So before we get to talking about the translation, Professor Lawrence and Habib, I was wondering if you could share a bit with our listeners, and I'm very curious to learn more. You talk a little about this in the book, but maybe the backstory of how did this collaboration come about? How did you think about writing and composing such a massive project of translating the Quran? How did this all come about? Maybe you can take turns in talking a bit about that.
Yeah, go ahead, Bruce, please.
I'll let Rafi start.
Okay. Well, I was talking to Norton Publishers about this. And of course, we're talking about over 10 years ago, because we've been working on this for at least 10 years. And so I kind of what initially inspired this was that most of the Quran translations, the extant translations, you know, a lot of them are extremely good and extremely competent, and they're done by Arabists. But often they were translated into an idiom which was not very readable. And so the idea was to create, to produce a translation which was user-friendly, which was reader-friendly, that would invite people in to learn more, and it would give them an experience that they would enjoy. So I was talking to Norton about this, and you know, we came to the conclusion that it would be good to have an Islamic scholar on board for this project. And because I come, you know, my expertise is in English and in Western literature and Western philosophy. So we were very fortunate to find Bruce Lawrence, who is an expert in Islamic literature and has written several books on the Quran. So that's basically my take on how we came together. Bruce might want to add something.
Well, I think I was just very lucky that Norton thought of me, and Rafi and I were able to collaborate. I think my own journey with the Quran goes back decades to when I was first an undergraduate and did Islamic philosophy and read some of the Quran in Arabic. And then, of course, in graduate school, when I worked with Professor Rosenthal, who insisted that we think about not only the Quran, but tafsir in very imaginative ways. But I never thought of doing anything on the Quran until I was approached by a general publicist to do a book on the Quran for a series of books that changed the world. And that was in 2005. And I thought, I've done one book, that's all I need to do. And then Rafi came along and said, no, it's not enough. You've got to think about the whole of the Quran and the translation. So I said to him, well, there are two surahs. If we have to think about working together, my challenge for you is to do two surahs that I've never been able to translate satisfactorily. And one is Surah Al-Ikhlas, the 112th surah, and the other one is Surah Al-Duha, 93rd. So what happened is that Rafi gave me translations of both of those surahs that were so different and so beautiful that I have to say I was just t taken off guard and decided that I could work with him. And I've never regretted that decision, but it was because he passed the test on Surah Al-Ikhlas and Surah Al-Duha. And I think in every single translation that we've done, we've kept that as a high water goal for each chapter of the Quran, is to make it as good as Surah Al-Ikhlas and Surah Al-Duha.
So I thought one good way to enter into our conversation today would be to talk a bit about the very title, which is the Quran, a verse translation. And in your the introduction to the translation itself, you talk about ways in which this translation is different because it takes very seriously the process of versification. And that's something which is absolutely correct, having read this translation myself. But I was wondering if you can share a bit with our listeners what that means, the versification of the Quran, a verse translation, because you also mentioned that, most places in the Quran do not follow some kind of structured, ordered Arabic meters or buhur. But that is the central way in which you've approached this translation. So I was wondering if you can speak a bit about this very idea of versification and a verse translation. What does that mean? And then from that, we will maybe talk about some further aspects of that. But perhaps let's begin with a general overview of what that means, versification and a verse translation.
Yeah, so I can address this, and then Bruce, I'm sure he will have something to add to it. So basically, when a lot of people they hear the title of verse translation, they somehow imagine that it's all going to be in rhyme. But of course, that's not the case, because most English poetry today is not written in rhyme. And so the first point of our title is that we translate the Quran verse by verse. Okay, so the Quran itself is presented in Arabic as independent verses, and we strive to retain that independence. That's one thing. But when we say verse, we mean that basically we're talking about free verse, but we're also talking about a number of poetic effects, because of course the Quran is not poetry, and the Quran is much more than poetry, but it uses a lot of poetic effects. So for example, it uses a form known as sajj, which is a rhymed and rhythmic prose. And so and it took us a long time actually to arrive at this. It took me a long time to arrive at this, because I was thinking, well, none of the traditional English meters fit this. I know none of the Arabic meters do either. But in the Quran, for example, you will have Allah at the beginning of a clause, and it's stressed, of course. In the natural rhythm of the English language is iambic, so it's like an unstressed syllable followed by a stressed syllable. And so in the English language, you don't normally stress the very first syllable of a clause or a sentence. But we found in the Arabic, we were kind of required to match the emphasis of the Arabic. And then eventually, it struck us that Sajj Is actually accent the meter is accentual. In other words, you don't count the total number of syllables, you only count the number of beats, number of stresses. So for example, in Surat al-Duha, you have wad-duha, that's one stress, wal-layli idha saja, a three in that line. Ma wadda'aka rabbuka wa ma qala, and you have five stresses in that line. And so what we tried to do was to translate it in a way where we only count in an accentual meter, where we only count the stresses. So we say by the morning light, in its brilliance, by the darkening night, in its stillness. There are more stresses here than in the Arabic, but we tried to create a kind of parallel. And so that's a kind of brief answer to your question. And perhaps Bruce will want to add something.
Yes, the other thing that I think needs to be added that really is important in what Rafi's done as a procedure, we also always had in mind the outcome, which is that the Quran would be better pronounced and performed than it would be read quietly in a corner. That there's something about the performance of it, the words, the musicality of the words, even if it's not poetry, it rises to the level of a kind of quality of delight for the ear. That must be heard if it is to be understood. So the thing that was always in the back of Rafi's mind and in the forefront of all of our efforts was to have something that is not only accurate and accessible, but also enjoyable. It has some of the pleasing effect of the original Arabic without ever assuming or attempting to replicate the beginning Arabic, the original Arabic, because that's not something that anyone can do or should try to do. But to make something that has an equivalent quality without being equal in its deeper meaning with the Arabic Quran.
And that point that Bruce has just raised is extremely important because, as you know, Sherali, most people don't read the Quran silently, and it's not really meant to be read silently. It's meant to be recited. And so the typical Muslim's experience of the Quran, as Bruce is saying, it is as an oral performance. And so we were trying to produce a translation which which would reflect something of the beauty. Obviously, we can't reflect the actual beauty of the Arabic, but something that would be beautiful in its own right when it's actually read aloud.
Terrific. So let's begin our conversation of the translation itself. But before I come to specific surahs or chapters, and I will come to Surah Duha in a moment, one good place to begin, as always, is of course the Basmallah. And there is a really fascinating discussion in the introduction about the choice of translation or the way in which it is translated in this book. And I'll have Dr. Lawrence speak a bit more about the process that went into this translation, but you settle on the translation for the Basmallah as the all-merciful, ever-merciful, which is a fascinating translation. So, Dr. Lawrence, could you walk us through a bit about how you arrived at that translation and the kind of thought process behind that?
Sure, and the part about it that is the most difficult is not the part that's Rahman and Rahim, although that's what I spend a lot of time discussing in the introduction, but to translate Allah as God. And that seems to many people just very simple that you either do it or don't do it. But there's actually a whole range of other decisions and other assumptions that have to be made. And I think it's fair to say, and Rafi would agree, that Abdullah Yusuf Ali, for all the flaws of his translation back in the 1930s, still remains a standard for a flowing, accessible, engaging translation of the Holy Quran into English. The kind of English that we would use today, but in its time, almost 100 years ago now, it was a very readable and engaging. In fact, many of my Muslim students, I don't know about you, Sher Ali, but other Muslim students whom I've been privileged to teach, when I ask them if you ever read the translation, the Quran translation, they say, well, of course, We always have somewhere at home or somewhere and ready use the Yusuf Ali translation of the Quran. And so one of the things that Yusuf Ali says in the introduction to his translation of the Holy Quran, this is almost 100 years ago now, is he wanted to make the Quran, make it English into an Islamic language, and he could only do it by translating Allah as God. So in other words, if one does not translate Allah, if one leaves Allah as Allah, so to speak, in translating the Holy Quran, one omits the opportunity to identify Allah as God. So I can talk, and I will talk about Rahman and Rahim, which are the two qualifiers of God. But the first decision which Rafi and I made, and we made it with a number of other people, but there are also other people, including, as you may know, Sher Ali, certain authorized translations of the Quran, where it's said that one can't translate God as Allah or Allah as God, so one has to just retain Allah. So it's always in the name of Allah, and then et cetera, et cetera. So that it may sound a simple, it is a very single or important single term to look at, but it has enormous implications for translating or not translating Allah as God. So Bismillah, we start out with in the name of God, and then the Rahman and Rahim. The thing that Rafi and I agreed on, and it goes back to a conversation I had with Ibrahim Abu Nab, to whom I am greatly indebted for all my whatever flaws, and there are many that I have in my own engagement with the Quran, whatever benefits I have that may help others, they come from Ibrahim Abu Nab. Because he told me that whenever you translate the Basmala, you must make sure that Rahman and Rahim are an echo. Each is an echo of the other. If you have something that has two different qualities or two different attributes, you've lost the power of the Rahman and Rahim. For instance, Muhammad Asad, whom we both acknowledge as a major source, even though we disagree with him, obviously, about theology, but also about the translation as opposed to just transliteration of some parts of the Quran. But even Muhammad Asad says that when you translate the Basmala, you must have the two terms, the Rahman and Rahim, in conversation. So he does, in the name of God, the most gracious, the dispenser of grace. So he retains the notion of grace. But to me, grace doesn't have the quality of mercy or compassion. And so Rafi and I were really debating between mercy and compassion. And I think the all-merciful, ever-merciful has a quality of precision, but also openness. And the two different aspects of Allah Ta'ala, of the being Fa'alan or Rahman, which is inclusive, most gracious or most merciful, all-merciful. And then Fa'il or Rahim, which is doer or dispenser or agent. So I think the two must go together, that on one hand it's comprehensive, it's the all merciful or all compassionate, full of compassion, whatever one wants to do. My friend Shaka Taraba is full of compassion, ever compassionate. So again, he retains the two. But I find full a little bit too heavy, so I prefer to have in the name of God, all merciful, ever merciful.
Wonderful. So now we will turn to some specific surahs, and I thought just to inform listeners that when we were thinking about how to do this conversation, I thought one good strategy would be, since of course this is a very substantive translation, to take some specific examples from the translation where I will share with our listeners the translations that are provided, and then have Dr. Habib and Dr. Lawrence talk more about what went into that translation and the thought process behind it. So, Dr. Bibi, you've already started to talk about Ad-Duha earlier in your answer to my earlier question, but let's now get to that a bit more specifically and in a more focused fashion. So, the translation which is offered, since it's a very brief surah, I'll just quickly read out for the benefit of listeners. It is translated as, "In the name of God, the All-Merciful, Ever-Merciful, by the morning light in its brilliance, by the darkening night in its stillness, your Lord has not abandoned you, nor is he abhorring you. What comes hereafter will prove finer for you than what came before, and your Lord will provide, satisfying you. Did he not find you orphaned and give shelter? Find you seeking and give guidance? Find you needing and suffice you? So do not oppress the orphan, nor reproach the one who asks, but proclaim the grace of your Lord. So, Dr. B, walk us through some of the features of this translation. I think it would be fascinating for our listeners to learn more from both of you, the kind of the translation process and the decisions that went into this really majestic and incredibly moving translation, not only of this chapter, but throughout this book.
Yeah, thank you, Shirley. So with Surah Al-Dhuha, the first thing I guess that we had to face was the word Dhuha itself, right? Because in Arabic, it refers to the brightest part of the morning, right? And the problem is, you see, there's no one English word to convey that. And so you end up having to, if we want to do it in a poetic way and to convey what it actually means in the Arabic, we had to say something like, by the morning light in its brilliance. Now, you could say, I mean, the other ways of doing this, you could say, by the brilliant morning light. But you see, but then we have to look at the next line. Because the next line, Layli idha saja, then in the Arabic you have a rhyme, right? Already you have dhuha and saja, and in English, if we said, for example, by the brilliant morning light. Then how would you get that kind of rhyme in? If we said by the brilliant morning light, we would have to say by the darkening light, we would miss that rhyme. So we actually split it up into two lines. We said by the morning light, so you have light at the end of the first line, right? By the morning light in its brilliance, by the darkening night. So
Right.
you got night at the end of the third line. So you have the rhyme of light and night. But then also you have in the second line, in its brilliance, and in the fourth line, we put by the darkening night in its stillness. So you have a kind of rhyme between brilliance and stillness. And so the thing is, it's definitely longer than the Arabic, but I think it achieves the same parallelism, but it's a bit longer in English. And that's usually the case because, as Bruce knows better than I do, and as you know, a lot of Arabic words, they're very rich in their meanings, and it's just impossible to capture. You can't translate one word for one word. Usually it does not work, you know. And I guess later on we'll talk about Surat al-Ikhlas and the words Samad. But that would be another example, you know. But I mean, does this kind of give you an idea? And maybe
Absolutely.
Bruce wants to add something to this?
Please, Dr. Lawrence.
Yeah, one thing I would add to it, which I think, Sherali, you would appreciate, is that of all the decisions that we had to make, the lyrical ones about the sounds and the performance of it, Rafi has captured brilliantly in the way in which he's described how we began this surah and thinking about it in terms of clusters that could be announced and pronounced in English that would have a kind of lyrical rhythmic effect. But the one word in terms of meaning that everybody looks at when they look at Surah Al-Dhuha is Wajadaka Dalan and Fahada, the verse which refers to the fact that the Prophet Muhammad was something before he was guided. And I say something because how you translate Dalan here is not the same as you translate Surah Al-Fatiha, gone astray. But it's interesting, even someone like Muhammad Asad makes no commentary on it, just says, let's see, I think his translation is something like, for this is of course the seventh verse of Surah Al-Dhuha, the 93rd surah. He found thee lost on thy way and guided thee. Well, lost on thy way implies that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was somehow not able to find his way. But what Rafi decided to do, and I agreed with him, is to put in a single word that doesn't imply lost or found, but implies looking or seeking. So instead of Dalin as being asking or looking or losing, find you seeking and give guidance. I think it connotes the same notion that the prophet hadn't yet had the intervention which came from Jibril, full blown, which led to the final revelation of all of the Quran. But there still is a sense in which he was seeking without necessarily wandering or losing his way, or as somebody else said, finding another kind of synonym that would put Dalin in a different range of meaning. So I think the poetry is really important in it, getting the versification right, but also seeking the right word. And I think seeking the right word in this particular surah was finding the appropriate translation for Dalin.
And what I would add to that, this very important point that Bruce just mentioned about Dalin. What we're trying to do here, I think what Bruce is talking about, we're trying to respect the tradition of commentary, which says, well, you can't talk about the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam in this way. I mean, you can't talk about him being, as Bruce said, lost or astray, as those people who are referred to in Surah Fatiha. So we're trying to, yes, we're trying to make it poetic. But we're also very sensitive to Muslim sensibilities.
Terrific. Let's shift now to a Madinan surah, that is Surah 22, the pilgrimage or Al-Hajj. I wanted to actually talk about, and this is something that Dr. Lawrence had suggested. I'm very glad that he suggested this, to talk about a specific verse of this surah as a great example of your translation method here. And that, of course, is the very last verse, which interestingly brings together the notion of Islam as an Abrahamic faith, and then also talks about the five pillars, and especially prayer and charity, salat and zakat, which, of course, the last part of it is very well known, and the sort of iconic statement, فَقِيمُوا الصَّلَاةَ وَأْتُوا الزَّكَاةَ وَاعْتَصِمُوا بِاللَّهِ هُوَ مَوْلَاكُمْ فَنِعْمَ الْمَوْلَى وَنِعْمَ النَّصِيرُ. And I just very quickly, for the benefit of listeners, will slowly read out the translation of this verse, the 78 presented in this translation of the whole verse. And strive for God with due effort. He has chosen you and imposed upon you no hardship in religion. It is the creed of Abraham. God named you as those who submit to his will, both before and in this book, so that the messenger might be a witness for you and you for humankind. And then the part that I just recited, be steadfast then in prayer, give in charity, and hold fast to God, for he is your protector, the supreme helper. Dr. Lawrence, could you walk us through this translation and how this sort of exemplifies some of the challenges of translation that you faced, especially in regards to these long sort of Madinan verses, like the last verse of Surah 22?
Oh, when it refers to God as Mola, and when it says Ni'mat al-Mawla, Ni'mat al-Wakil, Ni'mat al-Nasir, there are several ways in which you have to figure out how you're going to translate Ni'mat. Ni'mat comes up very, very often as an important, it comes up already in Surah Al-Fatiha, a version of Ni'mat in the Na'im. So there's a sense in which this is a really important word. And what I think Rafi had chose to do, and what I confirmed and applauded, was instead of just having how excellent a protector or how good a helper, to make it into a qualitative adjective. So it's the supreme protector, the supreme helper. God is your protector. So Mawla is repeated twice. Allahu Malaka, Ni'matul Mawla, Ni'matul Nasir. The supreme protector, supreme helper. That brings up something which I think is the most distinctive feature. Where we tried, and we didn't always succeed, but we tried, I think, succeeded in many places, if not most places, to render the Asma'ul Husna which this of course is two of, but because it's a qualified, it's Ni'matul Mawla and Ni'matul Nasir, often people just translate the Mawla and Nasir part and don't render the supreme or the qualifier as part of it. But what we've tried to do here, and also in the glossary at the back, is to indicate where the divine names, which are not just 99, although 99 is for tasbih purposes, for meditation and recollection, is the most important way of thinking about the Asma'ul Husna is 99. But as even Ghazali says in his book on this subject, there are many more. And Ibn Arabi says there are over 300 Asma'ul Husna in the Quran itself. So what we've tried to do in every place where there is something which is a divine name is to give it a capital. And if it's a double name like Ni'matul Mawla, Ni'matul Nasir, to give it two capitals, the Supreme Protector, the Supreme Helper. And I should just add that when Rafi and I were in London and we were having a session at SOAS and we read this part, one of the people who was there said, "I this is the best translation of these last two verses imaginable, the Supreme Protector, the Supreme Helper." I think there could be others that one might imagine as equal or better, but we're very happy that we did this way of highlighting, but also in blending the Asma'ul Husna with the rest of this glorious ayah from the end of Surah Al-Hajj. And Rafi, before you say something, I should just add that one of the other comments that people have made, sometimes questioning, but many times, most times confirming, is that when we had earlier in the same verse 78 from Surah Al-Hajj, that we named you Asma'ul Muslimin, Asma'ul al-Muslimin. We named you not as Muslims, we named you as those who submit to God's will or to His will. So the idea that Muslimun and Muslimin and Islam is the religion of submission or the creed of submission, and Muslimun is those who submit to God's will. The idea of doing this is not original to us. It's already there, of course, in Muhammad Asad and also in Abdul Halim's translation of the Holy Quran, that you don't, it's anachronistic to translate Muslimun or Muslimin as Muslim and Islam as Islam with a capital I, because when the Holy Quran was revealed, there was a sense in which all Muslims included both Jews and Christians and pagans who would become Muslims. So there was an idea that there was a notion, an impulse, if you will, a human instinct, part of the fitra insan, to want to believe in God and to submit to His will. So Rafi and I elected to make this a more selective and inclusive view of Muslimun and Muslimin and also Islam by saying Islam is the religion of submission, and those who are Muslim are those who submit to God's will.
And the only thing that I would want to add to the Bruce's excellent explanation of our thinking behind this is in reference to a point that you mentioned, Shirley, that this is one of the longer surahs. It, of course, it's not the longest by any means, but even in Surah Al-Baqarah, and the more kind of supposedly prosaic surahs, the longer legalistic ones, I think it does help the reader for lines to be broken down in this way, so that even these longer verses, longer surahs, they have a kind of rhythm which makes it easier. And the thing is, if you were to put all of this into prose, you see, a lot of people say, well, the Quran is not poetry, and that's true. But what they forget is it's not prose either. You know, and so if you look at the Arabic of this last section, I mean, look at the way we normally read this: wa aqimus salata, wa atu zakata, wa tasimu billahi. And so after billahi, there has to be a slight pause because you can't say billahi huwa maulakum. I mean, there's a slight pause, billahi huwa maulakum, right? So, what we do, we say, be steadfast then in prayer. And that's the end of the line. Given charity, comma, and hold fast to God. The ending of the line parallels that little pause after Billahi, right? And then, for he is your protector, the supreme protector, the supreme helper. And so, whenever you read the Arabic with tajweed, of course, you're reading it slowly, meditatively. And I'm not saying that we match that movement exactly, but I think we try to capture that overall cadence. Yeah.
Fascinating, truly fascinating. I want to turn to another Madinan surah, but again, a very specific verse. And this, of course, is perhaps one of the most iconic verses in the Quran that our audience would be quite familiar with. That, of course, is Ayat An-Nur, the verse 35 of chapter 24, titled An-Nur or Light. And again, I'll just quickly read out the translation slowly and then have both of you comment a bit about this translation. So it reads, God is the light of the heavens and of the earth. His light is a parable of a niche which holds a lamp, the lamp enclosed in a glass, the glass which glows like a gleaming star, lit from an olive tree, blessed, whose soil is neither east nor west. Its very oil would shine forth, though untouched by fire, light upon light. God guides to his light whom he will. He strikes parables for humankind, for God is knower of all things. And that's absolutely beautiful. Maybe you could again take turns, or whoever would want to talk a bit about this translation and some aspects of it that might be worthy of pause and notice.
I think this is for Rafi to do, and I just want to say, Rafi, that Shah, the only point where I disagree with you is when you say this is the favorite part of Ayat-Nur and Surat An-Nur. I used to think that, but then I read Rafi's translation of verse 41. I found that that was also equally beautiful because it claims that the birds with wings spread wide are also praying to God. So
Right.
I like the idea of the light as iconic, but also birds in prayer.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, so basically, I mean, what I would say in general, Shirali, is that again, it kind of the Arabic has a rhythm, right? Allahu nuru samawati wal ard, we say God is the light of the heavens and of the earth. We try to retain that kind of balance. There are a lot of parallels and balances in this. Mathalu nurihi kamishkatin fiha misbah, then al misbahu fi zujaja. And so we try to retain those kind of pauses. But since we talked about these kind of pauses in relation to another verse, maybe one thing we could mention here is in the Arabic, you see, sometimes you have a word in the Arabic which allows for ambiguity. But unfortunately, in translation, you have to make a choice and you have to go one way or another. So, for example, when we say "Mathalun Nurihi," so most commentators that we looked at, they the Nurihi, they think that refers to the his light refers to the light of God. But some interpret it as the light of the Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. But if it's the light of the Prophet in that verse, then you would have to use a lowercase h, right? So you got to make a decision here whether to use h with the capital signifying God, or with the lowercase signifying something else. And now the other, there are a lot of different interpretations, as you know, Shirley, of all these, other. So, for example, the Mishkat, the niche, it can be interpreted as the chest. But the Shiites sometimes refer it to Fatima, the daughter of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The lamp could be the Quran. It could be faith. The glass could be a believer's heart. In most of these cases, it doesn't matter how they interpret it. It's not going to affect the translation too much. But with certain words, I say with Nuri, it does. And then when we get to Nurun ala Nur, again, we translate the first Nur as uppercase with an uppercase L. And the second Nur, light upon light, we do it with a lowercase. So this obviously implies a definite stance. So what we're going with the interpretation that says it's the light of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala shining on the believer's heart, right? The light referring to the believer's heart. And then also later on, we have the word. We have the word. We put the word soil in. Okay, with the Arabic says, "Yuqadu min shajarat مباركة زيتونة لا شرقية ولا غربية." So literally, it says, neither eastern nor western, some commentators say, well, the root of this tree, it comes from paradise. It's not a tree of this world, so it's neither east nor west. And so I think the word soil, it has two functions here. It rhymes with the word oil, which makes it more beautiful just to listen to. But it also has that implication that its soil is not here, is not on earth. So it's a word we put in there. The word itself is not in the Arabic, but I think in some ways it clarifies the meaning of the Arabic. And of course, not everyone would agree with what we're doing here, but that's the decision, that's the process that we went through.
Dr. Lawrence, I want to now turn to another Medinan surah, one again of tremendous liturgical significance in Islam and Muslim life and practice, of course, Surah 55, Surah Rahman. You wanted to especially talk about, and I think now I understand why that might be the case. I mean, one of the very interesting things about the surah is that although it's a Medinan surah, but it has these very short verses with this sort of repetitive verse that is most repeated in this surah, "Fi bi ayyi ala rabbikuma tukadhiban," which you translate, the two of you translate very interestingly as, "Which of your Lord's favors would you both then deny?" But the verse that you particularly wanted to talk about, and it's a really pithy but incredibly meaningful and profound verse, is verse number 60, which of course is "Hal jaza'ul ahsani illa al-ahsanu," which you translate here as, "What is the reward for goodness beyond goodness?" Illa al-ahsanu, beyond goodness. That's really, tell us more about this translation. What is happening here?
Well, it was Rafi's idea, and I had to think about it for about 30 seconds before I agreed that even though the literal meaning was accept, that the idea of being beyond connotes what really is, I think, at the heart of this message is that because Ihsan, again, this is what Rafi is saying, we try to honor also something of the traditions of the hadith that are associated with many of these verses from the Holy Quran. And one of the ideas is that Ihsan itself is a culmination of from the Hadith Jibril is a culmination of thinking about Islam and Iman and Ihsan before the hour which comes at the end, the hour of reckoning. There is no other higher state of human possibility and human achievement than Ihsan. So I think when Rafi decided that instead of saying accept goodness, Accept goodness means that, of course, it's great, and you not goodness accept what you have as goodness. But beyond goodness applies an elevation, it applies a hierarchy of value. And I think it's there implicit in the Arabic. And so what Rafi decided to do by rendering illah as beyond instead of accept is to make explicit what is implicit in the Arabic in the English rendition. And I just also think it reads beautifully. What is the reward for goodness beyond goodness? So it's an obviously a rhetorical question to which the answer is nothing. And goodness is itself its own reward. And I think we have an endnote this verse says it's a reward in this world, but also a reward in the world to come. So it's a double goodness that's implied here, but it's not goodness in comparison to anything else. It's goodness that has nothing beyond itself to be commended.
I'm curious about a question in terms of your work process, in terms of how you did this translation. Did you sort of divide up first Meccan and then Medinan, or did you go chronologically, or was there any kind of order in which how? I'm just wondering because your translation so beautifully captures not only the cadence, the sort of the sound, but also, I would say, perhaps the thematic sensibility of these chapters. Medina and Meccan, eschatological versus more legally oriented. This one, of course, intensely liturgical. So I'm just wondering if you could speak a bit about, and this we'll come back to, and in fact, the last example we will talk about is of Surah 112 Al-Ikhlas. But before we get to that, could you speak a bit more about the progression of this translation and how sort of cognizant were you that your translation should also unfold with a certain kind of sequence and a translator sensibility, which tries to mirror the sensibility of the text being translated, if that makes any sense.
Well, I'll let Rafi answer for himself, but I think what he would say and what I would say is that we recognized that we were not a committee of two, but a committee of four. One of the things that happened, is, for instance, very early on, we knew that one of the challenging surahs was going to, they're all challenging, but one of the ones that would be especially difficult to render into any language, but including modern day English, is Surah Nisa, fourth surah. And so I remember when we were with Rafi and his wife Yasmina in New Jersey, we sat down and I think we spent 2 days on just the first part of Surah An-Nisa. So there was a sense in which we recognized that neither Rafi nor I could really capture the sensibility of this for someone who was a woman reading or reciting the Quran. And I should say that his wife is a marvelous reciter of the Quran in Urdu. And of course, you know that Miriam is a scholar of modern day Arabic, but very sensible to feminist appreciations of Islam. So we had the four of us, Rafi and I, with our two spouses, looking at this. And so and I think what that spurred us to do, this was maybe 8 years ago, was every other time that we came across particularly gender sensitive portions, but actually many whole segments of the Quran, we recognized that it would be better to have multiple voices and multiple input. Rafi and I would do something which we would chalk out as a kind of our initial translation, but then we review it with both Yasmin and Miriam.
Yeah, the only thing that I would add to that, I don't know if you remember this, Bruce, but we actually started the first surah that we translated was Surah Yusuf.
Well, that's right.
Wow.
And I remember at the time, and maybe this is maybe this is not the case now, but I remember at the time, I recall at the time, maybe incorrectly, I recall you saying that it was your favorite surah at the time. And you wanted to start with that. And I'm actually writing something on this surah right now, which I will show to Bruce when it's done. But it really is a fascinating surah, I think, because when you compare it with the account of Joseph in Genesis in the Old Testament, it really brings out, I think, a lot of the rhetorical features of the Quran, and it's absolutely fascinating. And just to go back to your question, Shirley, I think what we both have begun to recognize that this publication of this translation is really not the end of a journey, but it's the beginning of a journey. Someone asked us a few weeks ago, how did the translation change you? And I think that was a very pertinent question. I think certainly for me, it's made me a lot more humble, I hope, and a lot more aware of what I don't know.
I would echo what Rafi says about the about humility and also gratitude for people who are willing to suffer with us in trying to think through different variations of what is, in some ways, an impossible text to translate, but one, as Ibn Abu Nahb said, it can't be translated, but it has to be translated. So this our ironic contradiction where we're facing a text which is insuperable, untranslatable, and yet it's so beautiful and so eloquent that one wants to render it into this foreign language called English. So I think humility before the absolute and before the defiant is really something that Rafi and I have found from the beginning. But as we've gotten further into this journey, we've become more humble and more grateful for the help of others.
And Dr. Lawrence, your comment about Surat An-Nisa propelled me to actually go to your translation, revisit it. And I remember being very struck by, and I mean, not to focus on verse 434, which of course is a source of considerable controversy, especially in the contemporary period. And especially, of course, that one fragment of 434, Wadribu Hunna. But that is translated here as resort to harmless force. That's really fascinating. And your commentary just now about thinking about these verses in a gender sensitive fashion. I know we want to very want to go to Surah 112, Al-Ikhlas in a moment, but could you very briefly talk about this particular translation and these moments in the Quran, which are not only to do with questions of gender, but also questions of violence and jihad, etc. How conscious were you as translators when you would perhaps translate what one might call controversial verses in the context of intra-Muslim debates or Muslim non-Muslim debates or verses which have been scandalized by Orientalists and Islamophobes today? How conscious were you to the contemporary sort of context of these verses in relation to its linguistic features? How did the politics and the language come together when you were translating these kinds of controversial verses?
Well, it's a great question. And Rafi and I debated endlessly how to translate it, Darab Huna. And one of the things that we finally did when we decided, as we say in the introduction, occasionally to use bracketed qualifiers or addendums to things that would not be in the, as we did earlier, and then when we said righteous women are devout guarding, and it's not clear in the Arabic what it is, so we say guarding their husbands means and honor. So that's a very long, inclusive, but here at Darab Huna, resort to harmless force, as we said, and we try and keep the notes minimal, and the publisher Norton wanted us to keep the notes as brief and direct as possible. But on this one, we had a fairly direct statement about that this is the most controversial directive about women in the Quran, and while it advises use of force in context, it's with restraint. So how do you admit that there is a daraba, a drabuna, is force, but force with restraint? And so Rafi came up with the idea of saying harmless, and then at first we had it without a parenthesis, but then realized it's not really there, so we put it in parenthesis, then resort to harmless force, and then quoting without doing them elaborately the numerous hadith of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, where he says he condemns the practice of beating women and never even raised his voice to any of his wives. So it's not only what the Quran has revealed, but also the practice of the Prophet Muhammad, where he does not beat his own wife and does not raise his voice to her. So this is clearly something which is a use of mild reprimand or minimal force in order to enforce the feeling of the Quran.
Yeah, and the only thing that I would add to that is, as Bruce is saying, that we tried to respect what the we tried to bring out what we thought the verse actually meant, with reference to the Sunnah of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and with reference to the hadith, his sayings about it.
So one final example, I mean, it really this deserves a multi-hour conversation where we might go through each and every surah, but let's sort of as a final example come to Surah 112, Al-Ikhlas, which of course is this very short Meccan chapter, defined by its rhythmic quality. And of course, this surah, of course, is very familiar to students and specialists in Islam and also to Muslim audiences. But I think the hope in this book, and I really would highly recommend people beyond the study of Islam and also non-Muslims who just want to get access to the Quran in this really accessible fashion. So for their benefit, I just want to give the rhythmic quality of this surah, of course. Qul huwallahu ahad, Allahu samad, lam yalid, walam yulad, walam yakul lahu kufuwan ahad, which is translated here as, say, he is God, the one God, the absolute. Neither did he beget, nor was he begotten. His like or equal, there is none. Dr. Habib, could you walk us through this translation and what are some notable features to take note of?
So Rafi, I think Rafi has a lot to say about this, and the only word that I want to comment on is the samad, because Rafi and I, when we were first getting together back in 2011 and 12, we were talking about how does one translate samad, and you have the example of people who translate it as rock or firm base or as something that is eternal. Or I think, if I'm not mistaken, Muhammad Asad translates it as the eternal uncaused cause of all that exists. Well, that wouldn't make good poetry. I'm not even sure it makes common sense in even his wonderful translation of other parts of the Holy Quran. But for Rafi and I, there was something about Samad that was so critical because, first of all, it's a hapax legomena. It's the only time that this Asma'ul Husna comes up in the whole of the Quran, but also comes up in Surat Al-Ikhlas, so it's doubly important. It's not only a solitary, but it's also an emphatic announcement of who God is, and it qualifies Allahu Ahad, Allahu Samad. So there's a rhyme, but also equivalence and obviously a reciprocal value in Ahad and Samad. So how do you render the totality of that in something that is compressed language? So although Rafi is the philosopher of the two of us, I was the one who really said, I think absolute is the one term that connotes both eternal and inclusive and immovable. And we can't have all those qualifiers. So if we have to have one, let's have absolute. But Rafi was the one who decided that we should say he is God, the one, and then have the last, his like or equal, there is none. So there's a rhyme between the first and the fourth, and between the notion of oneness and none and exclusiveness of Allah Ta'ala. So that's my commentary on how we came up with this. And again, the decision to put it in the past tense instead of the present tense is the present tense in Arabic. But neither did he beget nor was he begotten, has a more consonant ring with the whole message of the Quran that God neither begets nor is begotten, nor was he begotten. So, Rafi, do you want to say more?
Yeah, I'll just add a little bit to that, what Bruce was saying about Samad. So, yeah, there's a lot of interesting commentary on this word. And some people say that word refers to the fact that la jawfa lahu, the God has no cavity, no interior, meaning that God is impenetrable. It goes back to the meaning of rock, as Bruce was saying, that God is impenetrable. Nothing can go into the divine, nothing can come out of it. But then other commentators say, well, that's kind of attributing to God some kind of corporeality. And they say, well, God actually is above the corporeal world. God is beyond being. And other commentators say, well, Samad kind of implies a being who's totally independent, but others are dependent on it. And again, so you got we have this situation coming up often, right? Where you got this Arabic word which has this incredible range of meanings. How do you convey all that? So I think Bruce came up with exactly the right word for that in absolute, because if you say something is absolute, it also implies that it's not relative. So it gets the idea of independence and others dependent on it. But it also I think it also alludes to the idea that God is somehow above corporeality. He is above the corporeal world, and that he's above the world of mere. I mean, to use Hegelian terminology, God is real, but reality is not mere existence. God is above mere existence, you know. And so, and then just in the first line, قُلْ هُوَ اللَّهُ أَحَدٌ. So ahad implies a kind of the interior unity of God, or the interior indivisibility of God, whereas wahid implies the unity of God relative to other things. And but in the Arabic, you don't have the definite article. It's just قُلْ هُوَ اللَّهُ أَحَدٌ. But in English, you can't really say he is God one, partly because that's not going to scan. You know, it doesn't sound right in English to have two separate words with a stress on them. But the other thing is, the implication of ahad in the Arabic is very strong, that of unity. But if you use it without the definite article in English, it doesn't have that same force. If you say he is God one, it doesn't necessarily mean the absolute unity, right? And so in English, you have to put the definite article, I think, both for the sake of the scansion for the meter, but also for the sake of the meaning. Because when you say he is God the one, you are kind of implying he is God, the absolute one, the unity, and not just any old unity, right? So those are the kind of things that we were thinking about.
Well, yes, and you know, I this semester only I'm teaching a class on the Quran, and I must say that I mean, I got this text in the middle of the semester, right before Ramadan, in fact, so it was a wonderful gift. And you know, as much as I think I really would agree with you that the current translations out there, Ahmad Ali, and you know, the Study Quran and others are incredibly useful sources, but there is a certain kind of impediment, especially with undergraduate students, when you know the whole sort of translations like thou and thee and so on. So this translation really did seem to be one that you know, energizes the text for a contemporary reader. And I would really want to punctuate for listeners the efficacy of this translation, especially for the undergraduate classroom, but also beyond. So the Quran, a verse translation by Professors M.A.R. Habib and Bruce Lawrence, published by Norton in 2024. As I said, we can of course keep on going. This is a true delight, not only reading this translation but also talking to you about it. And I think one thing that our conversation has really shown me is the deep thought process that went into this translation. And I think that thought process is quite visible for the reader because of the sort of dramatic mellifluousness and also the powerful impact of this translation at numerous places. So thank you so much for your time, and really thank you for this wonderful gift for educators, believers, and non-Muslims as well. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and thank
Thank
you.
you. I
Yeah, go ahead, Bruce.
was going to say, Sher Ali, thank you for the gift of this conversation and your excellent readings of the translation. It made me feel that you should be reciting the whole of it.
Yes, yeah, and thank you also, Sher Ali. And I just wanted to ask you before we finish. You just said something very beautiful, and you said this translation energizes the text for a contemporary reader. Do we have your permission to use this quotation?
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. That's the least I can do, the least.
It's
Thank you so much.
a wonderful it's a wonderful you know, I wish I could describe it in that way, but it's a wonderful description anyway, and very flattering to us. But thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you. So, this was my conversation with Dr. Rafi Habib and Dr. Bruce Lawrence on the Quran, a verse translation. I hope you enjoyed this episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. Please join us next time for another new episode. Until then, this is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Take care, stay well, and keep listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.